Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the patient episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and we've learned here on the Snap that the very people that look like they're holding it all together, those are the people you gotta watch. People like Dr. Lee Warren, a brain surgeon, who was with his family when he got a call that would change everything. Snap Judgment.
The first time I walked into the hospital, I went through the emergency department, and there's a long, probably 30 or 40 feet wide hallway that served as a staging area for mass casualties. All of the stretchers were empty except one. I see the nurse taking care of this guy. It looked a little bit like he'd been kind of cut up with a weed eater. He had little skin tears all over him from a bomb, basically, that had gone off. And the nurse said, "Oh, it's just a little bomb. Nobody died." And I didn't think about there being bigger little bombs at the time.
Lee's an Air Force neurosurgeon. He enlisted back in his 20s to help pay for medical school. He'd done a stint in Germany, but now here he was in 2004 in Iraq, the second neurosurgeon to ever be deployed since Vietnam.
The hospital was in, you know, tents, and they were calling it Mortaritaville because it was getting mortared every day, and there was just a lot of unknown.
Back inside the emergency room, Lee studied the man the nurse was tending to. There were four numbers scrawled across his forehead in black Sharpie marker.
It was 1856. The number written on his forehead, and really didn't know what that number was. And at first I was thinking it might have been some kind of Arabic inscription with his name or something, and because she said, "That's his name." And I said, "Well, what do you mean it's his name?" And she said, "He was a terrorist." She realized then that I was new, and she said, "Well, it's a numbering system. You know, we write their numbers down because we don't know who they are. So that's how we keep track of which patient is which." You had this notion that you're going to be able to look at a person and tell if they're bad or good, right? But then here I'm just looking at this kid who looked like the kid who delivered pizza to me in San Antonio. It's just this little teenage-looking young man. When I went to bed that first night, my head was full of thoughts of whether I had what it took to do this job well. I was worried. I didn't have the sense before I left that I'd be taking care of the enemy.
But Lee didn't have time to think about what it meant to be taking care of the enemy. Every day there were too many patients to take care of at the same time, American soldiers, insurgents, and the Iraqi civilians caught in the middle. The only sense of order came from the trauma czar, a general surgeon who called the shots. He decided which patient had the best chance of surviving and therefore got treated first.
More than once I had to go in between patients and you know, change clothes, change socks, change underwear because I'd be soaked in someone else's blood. I did have a hard time sleeping. There was so much noise. There was always a jet, a helicopter, a mortar, a gun, somebody shooting an automatic weapon. There was just noise all the time. And then after a few days, you had so much sort of fodder for your mind that when you tried to sleep, you just saw all these injuries and all the death. You could hear all the screams and the smells and all that. It was difficult. But after, I guess, a week or so, I was so fatigued that I started sort of just collapsing, you know, passing out.
Lee eventually got used to all the noise, but then his fear of getting blown up gave way to something else.
Somebody actually literally shot at me and the other neurosurgeon I was with a rifle. And then we dove behind a barricade, and almost immediately, American guards returned fire down a street that we couldn't see, and they fired back with automatic weapons a few rounds, and then it was over. But it really made me angry. I was like, "Hey, if you get shot, we're going to take care of you, but here I am, and you're shooting at me." It didn't seem fair. It was a constant source of aggravation that never really went away from me.
That began to change one day. It started with the bad weather. Lee could hear rain pounding down on the canvas tents. This was a good sign. More rain meant less bombs and less catastrophe in the emergency room. But then a colonel summoned the medical staff. He had bad news. All flights were grounded. They wouldn't be getting a resupply of medical equipment for a couple more days. For Lee and the other neurosurgeon, that meant they had to make do with the few remaining brain surgery instruments they had left. There were only four.
I was just hanging out in the hospital with my colleagues when the tech comes running down the hall, you know, literally saying, hey, mass casualty, 10 minutes out. My first thought was, you know, I hope it's really not true. I said a little prayer, and to my shame, I hope that all the injured people were not Americans. There was a car bomb, a series of car bombs that happened close to the base, and there were 20-some-odd Iraqi civilians and a bunch of U.S. Marines that came in one big wave. Within a few minutes, all of the beds in the emergency room were filled up. The trauma czar is walking around the room and keeping an eye on everyone and organizing the chaos. And we wound up with the first four patients having to go and have surgery.
Lee took the fourth patient, a young Marine named Lewis. He had a bandage on his head from either a bullet or shrapnel. It was hard to tell. But as Lee was getting ready to operate with the last set of surgical instruments, another patient was wheeled in, the number 2280 scrawled across his chest.
And he had lost tons of blood. He had a bullet in his forehead, significant frontal lobe injury on both sides, and was bleeding out. You can bleed to death from a scalp laceration, so he was in trouble before he ever got there in terms of blood loss.
And between Lewis and patient 2280 stood a corporal.
And I walked up and said, "Corporal, you need to get out of here. You need to go to the waiting room and let us do our work." And he says, "Please save Lewis. He's my friend. He's my best friend. We're going to do everything we can, but you need to get out of here." And then he turned around and he said, "This guy," pointing towards 2280, "is the one who shot Lewis, and then I shot him." So the corporal fired the shot that put the terrorist down.
The corporal was stoic, almost robotic. But Lee had seen enough of these men come through to know he was shaken. Lee promised him he'd do everything possible to save his friend.
The situation was dire. Both of these guys had life-threatening brain injuries and needed surgery right then. There was only one surgeon, there was only one set of instruments. The czar sort of left it up to me. I was having to make a decision to treat one of them and not the other. There was never a thought in my mind of letting the American go. But for the first time, sort of had this hit on my conscience that, you know, these are people that we're fighting. They're not nameless, sort of faceless, evil beings. They're humans that I'm dealing with, a person that happens to be identified as my enemy because of, you know, where we are and what the situation is. But I just thought I couldn't get past the idea that 2280 had a chance, and if I gave him a chance, then he might survive.
Still unsure about how or if he was going to treat both men with one set of surgical instruments,
I made the decision that we were taking both of those guys to surgery at the same time. So a few minutes later, we're in the operating room. I've got a razor, you know, a non-powered razor shaving the Marine's head, Lewis's head. A general surgeon named Chris is next to me, and he's shaving the terrorist's head. We're prepping both their scalps with iodine and preparing them for surgery. The technician, Nate, opens the instruments and sets everything up.
And at that moment, the other neurosurgeon walked in. He'd finished with his last patient and was ready to help out. But there was still only one set of clean instruments. So they brainstormed a plan and just hoped it would work.
I asked the nurse for the scalpel, and she placed it in my hand. And at the same time, Tim, my partner, the other neurosurgeon, received his scalpel. And we both made our skin incisions on the patients about the same time. We open the scalp. I take the drill to make a hole in the patient's skull and open the skull up until I could remove it. And then handed the drill to a nurse who was standing in between. And she poured alcohol over the drill to clean it, sterilized it as best she could, and then handed it to Tim, who continued to use that same instrument on his patient. That was just the only thing we could do if both of these guys were going to live. As I proceeded through the surgery, like I'd done hundreds of times before, everything was the same as any other operation except for this growing fear in my heart that we were doing something that we would never have done in the United States. Here we are in a dirty tent hospital in the middle of the war, in wounds that are already contaminated, and now we're using instruments that aren't completely sterile. Every time we passed an instrument between these two guys, the likelihood of one or both of these men getting a meningitis or a serious brain infection was very high. It was very, very terrifying for me. There were four or five times through that operation that Tim needed something that I still had, and when I was finished, I would hand it to him. But as time went along and the cases got a little bit more under control and more instruments went towards the other neurosurgeon's side, then it became clear that we were going to get both these guys through the operation at least. I finished my case first. So after the operation, I walked out into the surgeon's lounge and I noticed the corporal sitting there. He was holding his helmet close to his body and he was more sad and remorseful. And I told him his friend was alive. Lewis is alive and we've given him a chance to survive, but that's all I can say for now. And then he looked at me and kind of nodded and said, "What about the other guy?" At that moment, the speakers came on overhead and there was an announcement that they needed B or O negative blood because of a critical shortage in the operating room. And about the time I was thinking through in my own mind that wasn't my blood type, the corporal stood up and stepped past me towards the blood bank. And I said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "Well, I'm B negative. I'm going to go donate blood. Somebody needs it." I felt like I had to tell him that the guy they're calling for blood for is the guy you shot. I mean, the guy that hurt your friend. I see him, you know, stiffen up, his eyes filled with tears, and he sets himself up, and he said, "You know, people have done things for me that I didn't deserve, and I shot that guy, and now I have a chance to do something for him, so I'm going to." And he did. He went on to the blood bank and donated his own blood.
A few days went by, and patient 2280 woke up.
I walked into the unit where he was held. I saw him there, lying on the stretcher. He was sleeping, had the bandage still on his head. The monitors were all out. The 2280 had kind of faded from his chest. And I looked at him and just thought through all the things that had happened to him. And as I picked up his chart, I noticed his blood counts were back to normal. He had lost about 80% of his own blood in the operating room that day. That meant that most of the blood that he had in his body was from that corporal, the corporal who had shot him. I never saw him again.
Lee never saw the corporal or Lewis ever again either. He heard Lewis recovered and was transferred to the Army Hospital in Germany. Patient 2280, he was transferred to the Abu Ghraib prison later that day.
In fact, that's something about war that I think I never really expected to encounter until I was there, is that there's not a good answer or a right answer. There's just what you have to do to get through it.
For more of Dr. Lee Warren's experiences in Iraq, know that he wrote a book, No Place to Hide, A Brain Surgeon's Long Journey Home from the Iraq War. And he also has a podcast. The original score for that piece was by Renzo Gorio and was produced by Nancy Lopez. The stories you tell at dinner, to your friends, your neighbors, the stories that let you make better sense of the world. How much is that worth? How much is a community institution that brings you this type of insight day in and day out? How much is it worth? What might be the craziest time in modern memory? What is saying dialogue worth? Whatever you decide, that's cool, but put something on it. What is that number to call? What is that number to call?